Welcome to According to Craig, and a special episode with my friend Dr. Russell Boer. On this episode, we're in masks because it is socially responsible, particularly given that our dear friend Russ works in a high-risk profession as a doctor and a first responder, frontline healthcare worker in today's environment. So thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so excited to have you here.
Yeah, of course. Happy to take the time.
Now, as we talked about, we're going to get to a little bit, we're going to get to what the relationship of people with hospitals and doctors in today's medical establishment is and what it should be. And I think a lot of people are expecting us to talk about COVID, but I'm actually going to talk about more holistically the relationship of us to you and your profession and everything you do. But in the meantime, I first would love people to get to know you. So you grew up in Oregon.
I did.
And were you like always like you four with a stethoscope around your neck in this vein?
I think all little kids go through that. At one point I was going to be an astronaut, and then I was going to be a fireman, and then I was going to be a marine biologist, I think, as we went whale watching.
We had a marine biologist on the show, by the way, or microbiologist.
Honestly, during a pandemic, I think that was a far better choice in profession, but you know, being outside on a boat does sound really nice right now. You know, but I always liked science, and my mom worked in a medical office just at the front desk as a receptionist. And so I kind of got exposed a little bit through that, but I'm from a blue collar family. I'm not somebody who grew up in, you know, a lot of doctors come from like long lines of doctors. So it's an interesting, you know, kind of world to get into, as you know, are starting out on that path for sure.
Well, and what's interesting about that world is that if you don't come from a long line of doctors, you get a fresh take on this, right? And it's like you have the everyday experience, as do the vast majority of Americans, of like, okay, here's what I think of the medical profession as you're going into it. So, you know, how did you end up where you are now? Like, and what is it? You work obviously at an institution on the front line. I know that you've been on the front line of over 100 COVID cases. You work in intensive care, and you're and also in pulmonology, which for those who aren't listening is the medicine around the lungs on that front, right? And so how do you, more specifically, what do you do in those areas? Because you also have a significant component of research that comes into play as well.
I do, yeah. So, you know, working kind of backwards of like how I ended up specifically in pulmonary and critical care medicine, so what I do now, it's actually really funny. In medical school, the week of our pulmonary block final, I managed to get influenza and didn't study enough. And
darkly ironic.
I failed the exam. Okay. So the funny thing about this, I like to tell this to like my students now, because now I teach the same physiology course that I failed in medical school, is that I wouldn't have found out how interesting it was, except instead of just, you know, making one pass through all the material, I had to take it all again. And when you're taking a retake, you're horrifiedly scared that you might fail the retake. So I learned that really well. And I think I got like a 98% on the retake or something like that.
I don't think I've ever gotten a 98% on a test anyway. The only thing I ever read twice was The Sound and the Fury by Faulkner, and I didn't get that right either. So
it's a better choice, but far more entertaining than learning about the equal pressure point of the pleural space. So, you know,
what is a pleural space? So
the pleural space is the little envelope around your lung that it sits in your chest, basically. Okay.
So. Which is ironic that I should know more, considering that my father is a thoracic surgeon, but I am the black sheep of the family. So I
I hear you all know, of these things happen. I probably was supposed to be an electrician. So, you know,
well, you're still plugging things in and making them work at this point.
Yeah. The joke in critical care in particular is, what do I do all day? Well, I put tubes and holes in the body. And if there isn't a hole, I'll make one and put a tube in it.
So, okay.
It's a lot of what we end up doing.
And which is fascinating to me, because and it's a nice sort of segue to really the core of what I talk about. Like, people would expect, and people who've seen you on the news and local news or national news, you've had different opinions on the COVID crisis. And it's almost interesting. I don't want to talk, you know, we will obviously cover on it. How can you not at this point with the coronavirus crisis? But the reality is, you've been on the front line, and you've been in the front line of people when people are getting a really bad way about things. Right. And
yeah.
And it doesn't matter if they're 18 or 88, they can die from this. But what was interesting to me was when, you know, when we last spoke about this, you said something that really reframed my thinking on this, which is we keep thinking as a society, not about COVID, but about our relationship with doctors. Like, I go to the hospital to get cured. I go to the hospital and they're gonna fix this, right? And you said something pretty profound, which is like that we've got it all wrong. Like that's not how we should approach it. So what is the relationship? Like if the vast majority of America is like, cure me. Yeah. And your response is like,
Yeah, you know, intensive care units in particular are an interesting place because that's really, we put the people that are the sickest people in the hospital, in the ICU. And most of what we do in the ICU is provide life support. And the life support's job is to keep somebody alive long enough for whatever other treatments they're getting and for their body to rebound from whatever's been going on. It's not as simple as like you go in, I put you on a mechanical ventilator machine, you know, a respirator, and it fixes your lungs. In fact, all it does is it supports your body while your lungs aren't working very well.
Which is fascinating because we talked, this entire country for 6 months was talking about, we're going to produce ventilators, we're going to produce ventilators, we're going to produce ventilators. And everybody's like, oh, that's awesome. I think half the people thought ventilator was something that you put inside someone and it just became a lung. I think a good portion of people had no idea what a ventilator was, but a ventilator is a breathing machine, right? That like fills your lungs with air that goes to your blood to keep you alive.
Yeah. And I think at the beginning, I was one of those people that was worried that we needed to make more ventilators, that we wouldn't have enough. And in particular, you know, just when we talk about coronavirus infections, the most serious thing that can happen is the virus causes a ton of inflammation in your lung and then it doesn't work very well anymore. And the way that we compensate for that is by pushing air in under high pressure, which is effectively what a ventilator does.
Got very sciencey, very
quick. That's okay.
And this is the interesting thing. So when somebody comes to the hospital and is in ICU, and even if it's not in COVID, I mean, I've often said, you know, that the body is like this whole magical thing, right? Like we can literally saw someone open, like break their ribs, like get in there and then just piece it all back together. And then the body's like, cool, it's going to be a long time, but I'll come back around.
Yeah.
And we reframe this in a way of like, okay, I'm going to the hospital and they're going to like cure me. But in reality, I love what you're saying. It's like, it's to allow other treatments, not cures, to work is point one, and then it's your body to do its work in point two.
And that's not to say that there aren't medicines that are curative, like antibiotics for bacterial infections, for example, are curative. You get the right antibiotic for the right bacteria, you cure the infection. But a lot of the things that we do, especially like viral illnesses like COVID, for example, are really hard to kind of quote unquote cure because
everybody keeps talking about a cure.
It's just not really how viruses work.
You're like, that's not how science happens.
And that's not to say that there aren't, you know, curative treatments for viruses. We see this now in hepatitis C in particular, and that's new in the last several years. So I don't think it's impossible to think that we would create an antiviral medicine that is curative for COVID. But one of the interesting things with viral hepatitis, the curative treatment is weeks long, like 8 weeks, I think. There's new medicines coming out all the time, but treatment in a respiratory, you know, lung infection like COVID, these are usually self-limited, right? Coronaviruses are the same family of viruses that give you a common cold.
Right.
This one in particular, though, our body's never seen it before, so we have really no innate immunity just from encountering things that are close to it. And then on top of that, like it has some nasty features to it, in particular one that induces a ton of inflammation in the body. And so that's why we're seeing even in kids this like multi-inflammatory syndrome that kids get and this lung inflammation that adults get and blood clots and all sorts of weird stuff.
I read somewhere that it was like it was disease X, right? Like we prescribed a perfect storm and then it happened.
This is like a textbook. You know, my husband's an epidemiology trained public health professional now who works in clinical trial research. And we were talking about this as he did way more infectious disease epidemiology stuff than I ever did in school. I mean, he should. That's his master's right. degrees, and that makes more sense, right? But it's like
you have two PhDs and an MD, but not in epidemiology.
Yeah, not in that. That's not what I do. And I think I want to stick a pin in that because I do want to come back to that point. But it's like, you're right. If you were in a class and you were supposed to come up with like the worst set of circumstances, it's like easily transmissible, just lethal enough that it can reproduce in large numbers but still kill people. Like, it's very problematic.
So what is, and this is a stupid question on this front because I'm gonna have a lot of those, a curative treatment, is it a cure or is it just something that makes it die down long enough and it just stays with you forever as long as your body keeps responding?
So there's that's actually a really good question, not a stupid question at all. Some viruses, like hepatitis C, for example, that we do have a curing treatment for, it is able to be eradicated because it doesn't have what we call a reservoir in the body where it can hide from medicine. And the way that antiviral medicines basically work is they stop the virus from being able to reproduce. And then over time, your body will find and attack and kill the viruses that are left over. And then if there aren't making more, your body will clear the ones that are there.
Okay.
COVID's in this middle place where it is not lethal enough to kill you before you can pass it on to someone else. But in a small proportion of patients, it is very, very serious. In all cases, though, the fact that it's self-limited, that it tends to be a short course of illness, makes it really hard to quote-unquote like cure with antiviral medicine because it doesn't reproduce in your body for that long anyway.
So, but that's interesting because, we have a lot of discourse. Like somebody very high profile says, we have a cure, and what they really mean is we have a treatment that like accelerates the body's recovery period.
Right, and that like the drug remdesivir, which was just approved this week by the FDA, works by keeping the virus from reproducing, and you clear the virus faster. That's basically effectively what it does, but it doesn't make the virus go away immediately, and even the small amounts of the virus trigger your body's immune system. And when you feel sick from the virus, a lot of the reason you feel sick is your immune system is trying to get rid of it.
Okay. So when we extrapolate, which I don't think a lot of people are like, this made me sick. But in reality, your immune system is making you sick when it's fighting something, which is kind of these basic science facts, which I'm sure we were all supposed to learn in the 10th grade in biology, like didn't carry over.
Look, I'm a triple board certified physician with a PhD in public health, and the immune system is full on witchcraft as far as I'm concerned. So it's like no one except for immunologists understand it, how it works completely. Not all doctors know all things about all things. And I'm willing to admit I do not understand beyond a rudimentary understanding of how the immune system actually works.
Well, that's the fascinating part. So, I think in reverse to this, when I went to law school, everyone's like, oh, what did you study? And I was like, no, in law school, you don't study specific types of law. Like I took classes in citizenship. I took classes in taxation. I took classes in corporate law and copyright, but you don't graduate from law school having specialized in something. Now in medicine, you do. But it's kind of you have the reverse public perception, which is like, I go to my doctor and my doctor can cure me of everything. And you're like, your doctor's like, you need to see a specialist for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, right, we and realistically in medical school don't really specialize very much either. It's all about learning the how to integrate all the information. A lot of it's about how you make decisions, how you interpret data to make those decisions. And it's mostly actually like it's a lot of fundamental knowledge learning of like facts, but a lot of it is process learning, like learning how to do things. And we don't really specialize until residency. So, your average physician spent 4 years in undergrad getting a bachelor's degree and then 4 more years in medical school to get a doctorate degree. A short residency in something like internal medicine or general pediatrics would be like 3 years. A long residency in something like neurosurgery would be 7 years.
I mean, my dad says he was in school for 20 years. So yeah. That seems appropriate.
And so like for me, I did internal medicine, which was 3 years. I was a chief resident for a year, which is kind of an administrative teaching, role. And then I did a pulmonary and critical care medicine fellowship, which is 3 more years. So if you tally everything up, like from high school, it was, 16 years before I was done with my training and able to practice without supervision. So you know, there is something to be said about that amount of experience. And even the first 2 years that I was practicing independently, I felt very much like I was learning on the job. And I still do. I learn new things every day.
So this is the interesting thing. So how, you don't have to answer this question. So how annoying is it when someone diagnoses themselves off of WebMD when you have 16 years of training?
Well, so I think the both diplomatic and correct response to this is that your doctor is always going to be glad that you're taking an interest in your own health. And trying to do things to learn about it is great. But the internet is not a substitute for
16 years of
school. For that, for the experience, right? And that's like, it's not any different than any other expert. Like, I wouldn't try to write my own will. I call a lawyer. My taxes are complicated enough living in California and being married and like having consulting and all sorts of things to keep track of. Like, I don't do my own taxes. I hire an accountant. If there's a problem with my dishwasher, I don't try to redo the pipes. I call a plumber. You know, there's something to be said about expertise. And I think that expertise in medicine, I'm glad that medicine has been democratized and the information has been made available to people to engage in their health. But there isn't a substitute for experience.
So what's interesting is we spent all this time where we've democratized information around people's health, but we haven't democratized, we haven't empowered that democracy with action. Like, we haven't empowered people with education about what to do with that information. Like, there's this information paradox and that there's so much information available to people and they don't know what to do with it, which is the whole reason that I wanted to talk to you today, because I feel like if there was like one message to take away from this, like, it's this reframing how people think about the medical system, right? Like, you know, there are what, millions of viruses, right? Like,
there's a lot of stuff that can make you,
like, there's a lot of things that can make you sick. And the idea, just the fundamental idea that like, no one had, like, COVID-19 was a mutation somewhere at some point in a bat to a human. And it, like, that can and will happen. I remember my doctor telling me 3 or 4 years ago, like, you know, there is another one coming. Like, you're getting flu shots every year because it could help. It may not, like, but there's no downside to this. But it's reframing the concept of our relationship to our doctors, to hospitals in particular, of saying, oh, like, I have a personal responsibility to do the things that are necessary to give my body the space and the tools to heal.
You know, in the world of pandemic that we live in right now, the best thing you can do to help yourself get better is just don't get sick in the first place. Like, you know, we're sitting here in these masks, these like silly face covering things that, you know, actually scientifically have been shown to dramatically reduce transmission of infection from person to person. So you're protecting yourself, you're protecting your community by wearing a mask right now. And until we have a way that, like a vaccine, for example, to reduce the risk, this is probably the best we got for the time being. That and being careful and conscious about where we go, when we go there, with whom we interact, you know, creating that protection around us by not mixing virus around. Because just because you or I might not get super sick and hospitalized or land in the ICU and die, and it's not necessarily even that, because I see, I've unfortunately taken care of several young people who are even younger than I am who died of coronavirus. Or if didn't die, you know, on a ventilator in an ICU for 6-8 weeks with a, you know, at the end, not able to lift their arm up off the bed because they're so debilitated from being bedbound in like a medically induced coma for weeks. You don't want that to happen to you. And the best thing right now, even if you don't think it's likely, because you're right, it probably isn't likely. But it's not likely that I'll die in a car accident driving the 2.5 miles between your house and mine, but I wear my seatbelt and I look at what's going on around me and I'm careful.
Well, it says something pretty profound. I think we have this impression of this like magical operation, right? We've been searching for a cure for cancer for decades, a cure for HIV for decades. And it says something pretty profound. Like, there's incredible work that's being done globally now around a vaccine. There's incredible work that's being done globally in all of medicine. And we've made light years of accomplishment considering 150 years ago, if you said something about bacteria, you were burned at the stake, or 200 years ago, right? Like, you know, it's like, it's, that's pretty rapid progress in 150 years, but it also says something. You know, we had another guest on the show, whom you know, Sean, who works with microbes, and he was talking about how we know more about the surface of the moon than we do about the bottom of the ocean. Yeah. And it says something pretty profound that we don't know about us as a society, that we don't know anything about what's at the bottom of the ocean. And with the single most infectious and crisis creating disease in over 100 years, our chief protection is a piece of cloth, right? Like, that's, and that's not a denigration of the medical establishment. I think it's something pretty profound about like how powerful the world is, yeah, and how like how much we have to learn and do, and like, and how we have to reframe. Like, you can't just go to the hospital and be like, make me better. And when people, any number of people I've heard say, be like, you know, so-and-so didn't cure my grandfather, and so-and-so didn't, you know, it didn't fix my mom. And you're like, that's not what this was designed to do.
Yeah. And that's, you know, there are some cancer treatments, for example, when, especially if given early, can be curative, for example. And there are diseases that we can eradicate with treatment and make go away completely, but a lot of them we can't. And especially in you know, times like now in the pandemic, I think that we're being a little reductive when we just say we're going to find a cure for COVID and like we're going to go back to normal. It's not that straightforward, where you can just, you know, if you get infected, you pop two pills and you take a nap and you come back an hour later and right as rain, there you go off to go back to whatever it was you were doing before. That's just not how it is. It doesn't mean that we don't make scientific breakthroughs all the time. And there are legitimately, you know, medical breakthroughs like antibiotics, for example, in specific infections. Like, you know, Alexander Fleming discovers penicillin on some mold in his lab, and the course of humanity, which was dying of wound infections and everything all the time, is completely changed.
My cuts and my bruises would have killed me, except for penicillin.
I mean, it's honestly, right? Like, Civil War times, all you could really do is like cut it off.
Well, that seems pleasant.
Yeah. So, I mean,
then again, you're opening and putting holes in things and putting tubes in them. Just, so it's full circle.
Medicine operates at a pace that I don't think anybody who doesn't work in it really understands. Like, I have forgotten more things about medicine than doctors, you know, 150 years ago knew about the human body.
Oh, like, we went to Egypt and my father pointed to a temple and like to an inscription of a tool. And he's like, I'll be using that in surgery in 2 weeks. And I'm just like, what?
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of crazy to think about, like, you know, there are drugs that came on the market when I was in school that are already off the market because they didn't work. Like, they made it through trials in kind of post-approval monitoring. They found that they weren't really doing what they thought they were doing. And so we don't use them anymore. Like, we start and stop doing things for people all the time that we thought worked. And then over time we learn. And that's one thing that's really awesome about medicine, is that it's a constantly self-evaluative process. Like, we're always looking at what we do. And honestly, like, the type of research that I do is I take data that we collected just to take care of people that was going to get thrown away, and I analyze it to look for ways to provide safer, more efficient, more cost-effective, like, better healthcare.
So that's like the Etsy. You take found objects and turn it into something that is actually useful, but way more advanced and requiring a lot more education.
I mean, it's mostly just fancy math, but
I'm very terrible at math. So, like, I'm glad this is in your hands.
Oh, me too. The computer does all the work. I just tell it what to do, but yes.
Got it. Every time I tell the computer what to do, it yells at me and shuts down. So pull the thread on all of this. I think, you know, there's the obvious lessons of like, wear a mask, and then, but I think the more interesting question is, why is the mask the most effective treatment? A lot of people are like, well, why haven't we moved farther right now? Like, they don't realize, was it mumps was like the fastest vaccine, and it was 6 years, and even that one had to be redone, and there were problems with it. And so there's this impatience in society that we get from watching 60-second clips on the Today Show and
100%.
And cat videos on YouTube, and like it's not medicine's fault, it's your body's fault. Like, your body is unwilling to adapt to your impatience. Medicine's job is to keep you alive long enough for your body to be able to do that.
And then certainly a lot of it, you know, and one of the things that underpins like your comment about why don't we have better treatments yet is, you know, the way science really works is you disturb a system somehow. And so you disturb the system by introducing something new or taking something away. In this case, we got a virus, you got cells with a virus in a dish. We add a medicine that we think might work. We see if anything changes. And you do that, you know, 50,000 times because you want to be sure before I just start giving you medicine that might be poison.
I've seen The Walking Dead and the zombie of it all. I'm going to pass you don't want on that. Any of that.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that's just phase one when you're testing it in a lab. And then at phase two, you're testing it on some people to see what dose is the right dose to get a response. And then phase three, you're testing it on more and more people. And you just, you know, it's a stepwise process and we are deliberately very careful. And honestly, a lot of the bottleneck in getting stuff approved quicker is we have to get enough people into these studies who are willing to participate because people have to volunteer. So if you want science to move faster, go volunteer for a clinical trial. And, you know, that's one way you can help. Another way you can help is listening to public health advice, especially in situations like these, so that we don't overwhelm our system so much at once that we can't take care of everyone. So,
well, listen, that's a message we hear a lot. And I think it's a good one in that vein. And I want to thank you for joining me today to talk about it, because I think it's helpful not only to reframe the conversation around COVID, but to reframe the way people look at the medical system and look at the intersection of COVID in the medical system, right? Like, this isn't, if we move beyond COVID, it's not like our relationship to the medical system is going to change. We need to understand the basic fundamentals of science, and they didn't cover clinical trials in high school. So, you know, it's like, you know, it's almost like there's a public education component to this of like, you know that you, like, this is how the bank works, right? Like, you go in, you give them your money, blah, blah, blah. In this case, this almost seems like in the public interest to be like, hey, here's how medicine works, right? And here's how to make use of your doctor. And it would almost, maybe a little advocacy point for health insurance companies. It might help health insurance companies keep costs down if they trained people and educated people on how to use their health insurance, on what a physical is and why it's important, because Lord knows that people aren't getting enough of them. And in other cases, people have no idea what and how. And
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, like, finding a physician that you're comfortable with who can help you navigate this is really key.
Or in my case, finding a physician to become friends with who will help you navigate it is also very key.
And there are good sources of information. I think professional societies of doctors, so places like the American College of Physicians or the American Academy of Pediatrics for Kids, for example, these are groups of doctors who come together and come up with guidelines that apply to everyone. And it's, so these things are vetted. It's not just like going down like a Twitter K-hole.
Right.
Not that I'm on Twitter and I try to put out health information for people and stuff that's pertinent, especially to my own research. But, you know, you have to realize that everyone online has an opinion and not all opinions are created equal.
Right.
So choosing where you get your information from, I think, is really important. And professional societies are a great way for, you know, the public to get opinions that are filtered and vetted by other people with that same profession.
Got it. So yes to American College of Physicians, no to Twitter K-holes.
Yes.
Got correct. It. Well, that seems as happy a guidance as anyone can get. Thank you so much for joining and for sharing your perspective and your expertise and your time. I know how valuable it is, particularly in this crisis. And so thank you so much for coming to be on the show.
Yeah, of course.
And thank you to everyone for tuning into this episode, a special episode on the intersection of COVID and really how we should be reframing our understanding of our relationship and what medicine is there to do. Thanks for tuning in to The World According to Craig, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to The World According to Craig. The inside secret is not actually according to me. It's according to some of the most interesting people I know and their opinions on the things that affect us most. Together, we're just trying to make sense of the world, and I hope you'll join us every week.